and you're with me, Noel Debien, on The Good Life. My guest, Dr. Holly Kerr Forsyth, author of Gardens of Eden and columnist in The Australian. Holly, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Noel. How are you?
I'm well. I'm interested to begin with the beginning of your book in itself. The name, The Gardens of Eden, there's a great deal behind the name, the idea of paradise. Why did you choose that name? You even begin the book with a little quote from Genesis.
I very much feel that gardens are spiritual places. I feel a great deal can be resolved in the world by looking at gardens and going to things of beauty, which is very much the idea of the paradise garden in ancient Persia. A pristine wilderness, a beautiful forest, a place untouched by human hand, but then also a constructed garden. These are all places that I find Eden-like and places of sort of perfection, calmness, and spirituality.
The very word garden implies human artifice of some sort, doesn't it?
Yes, a garden is, yes. William Kent said, one of the great three, the triumvirate of great landscapers of the 17th and 18th century in England, said, a garden is a constructed place. A garden shows man's intervention. And so I suppose that is a garden is a constructed place, but I also feel very much that the garden is the wider landscape. And the greatest gardens, the gardens I love most, are those that have a very clear sense of genius loci, where they've really respected the environment in which they sit. They don't clash with the environment. They might be constructed, they might have walls built, but the walls are built of local materials. They're not built of sandstone if it's a basalt area. They speak to the landscape in which they rest.
The book ranges across many cultures. I can think just offhand the Australian gardens, Chinese gardens, Italian gardens, American gardens, Persian gardens. And that's just what I remember offhand. What inspired you to draw all those different cultures and places together into one book?
Well, for many years, I have wanted to sort of walk the Bible. It's really been something that I have read about and I would love to do it, and one day I will. I wanted to also go back to the beginnings of garden history. Where was the Garden of Eden? And of course, we think, scholars think, that it was Mesopotamia, southern Iraq, where the Hanging Gardens of Babylon were, Nebuchadnezzar's great Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Well, I couldn't get to southern Iraq for obvious reasons, so I went to somewhere very close by, to Persia, to modern-day Iran, to look at the beginning of garden history, because I wanted this book to start off with the very beginning, lessons in garden history. How did it all begin? Who thought of the garden as paradise, and why do we still think of the garden as paradise? And, of course, the word paradise comes from the Persian word paraditsa, which was a royal hunting park. So I went back to Iran. I went to Iran the year before last and drove all over it and photographed the gardens and the landscape and saw what they do, how they use the water that comes down from the mountains when the snows melt, how they collect that water in hundreds of kilometres of underground canals, and how they use that to create sort of moving, mesmerising, cooling, wonderful small rills, tiny water features, but large water features as well, and how important that is in the idea of paradise, an enclosed space with scented fruit trees and water running through it.
And that water seemed to be quite an aesthetic feature of those Persian gardens.
Absolutely. All the Persian gardens had water as a central feature of it. They were all inward-looking, all crossed by several canals, several water features. And that idea has come from, we think, the four rivers of Mesopotamia, the Tigris and the Euphrates, within which this incredibly fertile land existed since pre-Christ.
So that choice of Iran, of Persian gardens, is really trying to reach back right back to the origins of human civilization, where that comes from. But that's been changed since, or it's developed since, of course, because we're talking now, there's also the Muslim sensibility and sense of space and aesthetic as well. For example, I was not surprised to see no statues, for example, in those gardens. There was a spareness about representation. It was all done in nature alone.
Yes, I certainly don't recall any statues at all in any of the Iranian gardens that I saw. Just quite a restricted palette of Judas trees, Cirsa siliquostrum, almond trees, other fruit trees, a great emphasis on citrus, and then water and beautiful, beautiful tile work with lovely colours. And, of course, the mosques in all the squares and that overlook all the gardens are extraordinary works of art. So I suppose no need for statues when you have that sort of exquisite artwork on their religious places.
Likewise, you went and looked at Chinese gardens, some quite ancient.
Yes.
What is it about Chinese gardens that that just proves so attractive? What is going on there?
Well, it was very important to me to go to China, which I did exactly this time last year, because an eighth of the world's plants, 31,000 species, are actually native to China. The plants we take for granted, magnolias, camellias, rhododendron, many of the roses, are all native to China. And of course, 16th, 17th, 18th century, the explosion of interest in horticulture throughout the United Kingdom and throughout Europe saw the great families sponsoring plant hunters to China and the Himalayas, the subcontinent, to bring back these new and exciting species of plants. Many of those plants via the United Kingdom then came to the new colonies of Australia to become just commonplace in our gardens. So I really wanted to go back and look at where all those plants come from and where they are native.
I have to say, though, even when I walk into a garden such as the one in Sydney, which was a gift from the Chinese people, it's a constructed Chinese garden, I nevertheless, in looking at the plates in your book, saw an absolute unity. Rock was present. There was a certain wildness of feature. There was water was present. Mm. There was an attempt to recreate some sort of microcosm in the Chinese garden, I think.
Well, in the earliest Chinese gardens, and Chinese gardens reached their zenith, if you like, in the Southern Song period, the 12th and early 13th centuries, and they were very much the gardens of scholar officials, the elite. The poets, the writers, the artists of the day sought to represent nature, to re-represent nature and to redraw nature, to show that they could live in harmony with nature and respect nature by recreating it in their gardens. So in China, in respect of the landscape, you see soaring rock features, whereas in Japan, to where Chinese garden making was then transported, you see much flatter rock formations because the landscape, the topography, is much flatter in those islands of Japan than it is in the Chinese landscape.
And you'll also see waterfalls and watercourses in these same Chinese gardens.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you just have to sort of sail down the Yangtze River to realise how important water is throughout China. And then, of course, you see the soaring peaks on either side, mist-covered mountain peaks dripping with sort of greenery, and you see what they've been trying to create in those gardens of that early gardening period in China.
One that you incorporated was the Humble Administrator's Garden. Mm. I suggest the name might be slightly ironic in retrospect, but it's a couple of hours west of Shanghai.
That's in
it's
Suzhou.
In fact, yeah, indeed, it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Yes,
why does
now.
It become so?
Well, it was the home of a politician, you know, several hundred years ago, reconstructed more recently, and embodies all the aesthetics of Chinese landscape and garden making. Two-thirds of a garden should be water. Mountains should be represented in rockwork. Pavilions are built to honour nature. There'll be the fragrant cloud pavilion and the fleeting snow pavilion and the softly scented pale blossom pavilion.
There is a sense of microcosm going on there, though, isn't it? I can hear a little landscape being contained within the garden,
exactly.
As it were.
Yes.
Well, actually, an entire landscape being put into a garden.
Yes, and throughout all these Chinese gardens, there are great expanses of water. But around all those expanses, walkways are built and viewing platforms, because very much part of the Chinese aesthetic still today is to sit and quietly rest, contemplate, watch the water, enjoy the green canopy of the trees.
Is it just me, though? I walk into a Chinese garden and I feel that sense of wind down.
Mm.
What I want to do is sit and watch the carp float under the bridge.
Well, I think any place of beauty is a place that calms you down. An exquisite environment where each detail is respected and the place in which it rests is respected is a calm place and a place of beauty.
Now, you mentioned Japan, that Chinese gardening was taken forward onto Japan. There is a relationship between the two cultures, but there's something quite different. While there's similarity, there's nevertheless something quite different. It strikes me that there's virtually a more Buddhist influence, I think, would be fair to say, among the Japanese gardens.
Well, Buddhism went to Japan from China in the 5th century AD, but then has evolved into various sects in Japan yes, those gardens are very, very different. And I think I would have to confess that I like the Japanese gardens more than the Chinese gardens. They're very much of their place. And the Chinese gardens are very much of their place. And again, I'm repeating this theme that I feel it's so important, whether we're gardening in Australia or France, on a hilltop in Italy or in China or Japan, that we respect where we are. We respect the culture within which we're gardening and the landscape within which the garden is set. And the Japanese garden certainly respects that. I spent a week in Kyoto this time last year and arrived to the very best cherry blossom season that they'd had in 50 years. And everything about the Japanese aesthetic, about the kimonos that they wear at that time, the tea bowl that they use, the sweets that you might buy in the shop, respect that season. There's a cherry blossom on everything you buy. In autumn, the tea bowl will have a coloured leaf on it. The kimonos that the women wear for particular festivals will reflect the autumn season. And I love that about the Japanese. And there's this wonderful sort of conflict but togetherness about, you know, these sort of young kids in Roppongi in Tokyo with their spiked hair and their weird makeup or their goth look. And yet they respect their history. They also respect the aesthetic of the changing, fleeting season. I love that about the Japanese culture.
You featured, among others, the gardens at Ryoanji.
Ryoanji, yes.
I was struck by the raked stone gardens. Mm. What's this about?
Ryoanji is probably the most famous dry garden in the world. Again, a particular sect of Buddhism. Many of the great Japanese gardens, have raked areas, and it can represent lots of different things. The stones at Ryoanji can represent mountains. The raked area can represent the sea, or it can represent a flat landscape. You're allowed to interpret as you wish. What is so wonderful about all the raked gravel in the different Japanese gardens is that it reflects the weather. The Japanese have a different rake for every day of the year and for every weather pattern. So if it's going to be a day of inclement weather, the raking will be different and done with a different rake. If it's a beautiful, calm day, maybe a finer rake is used, I don't know. But you're invited to study the raked patterns and just to enjoy that sort of calmness about the oneness and the sameness of that space that you're looking at.
I can't help but notice, though, the seemingly high contrast between the Chinese garden, the Japanese garden, which is somewhat related, and the formal European garden. The formal European garden seems so much more controlled, is the only way I could put it. Do you get a sense of what I mean here when I look at a clipped, carefully pruned hedge and box hedge outside Schönbrunn with tulips in concentric circles? It somehow looks like much more pattern is imposed in the European garden.
Well, I guess you have to look at the history of landscape in each culture. You look at Le Notre in France. Then you move to England and you look at William Kent, Capability Brown, Humphrey Repton, and you look at the history that they were writing and the history that they are interpreting by their garden making and their changing landscape styles, those three garden makers over 100 years had very differing styles and were reflecting, in fact, the industrialisation of England and what was happening socially and culturally in England. I mean, that's a whole other book there.
Of course.
And you go to Japan and you look at the Zen Buddhism, so you step back. You respect patina and age and kirei-sabi, which means beauty and rustic and pastoral simplicity. Totally different aesthetic, coming from a different, totally different cultural base than Europe. So I think the gardens do reflect in each country the spirituality of the people and the culture and the history.
You featured Bramante's garden, the Villa Lante at Bagnaia, and about an hour north of Rome. Now, that's a classic of its type and had great influence. It's not, just when I look at it as a layman, it's not as formal as later gardens I would have seen. While it is formal, of course, it's highly constructed. It strikes me that there's an attempt to merge sculpture with rock. Mm. There's an attempt to keep water moving. There is a link with nature, even though it's formalized.
Mm. And this is a very important garden. It's a great example of high Renaissance, Italian high Renaissance art. Terribly important. It's why I think it's the second garden in the entire book. Lessons in Garden History. The three overriding essentials of Italian gardens: water, evergreen plants, conifers, and stone. Three essentials of Italian gardens have then moved to England and have greatly influenced Edwin Lutyens and Gertrude Jekyll, and can be seen through other parts of Europe as well in their garden. So Italian gardens, very important in garden history.
And take off into America, because of course you feature Monticello and many other American
and
gardens.
And Beatrix Farrand was also very influenced by both Jekyll and Jekyll's, and the fact that Jekyll was influenced by the Italian Renaissance gardens, and our Edna Walling.
Indeed, these are all great names of gardening.
And they're all intertwined.
Which are all spoken about in your book. One last question I want to ask. There's so much we could talk about. There's so much in the book and so much that springs from the book. But I got to Singapore's botanic gardens. Mm. And in looking at that, it struck that sometimes climate is almost as important as culture in determining what a garden is.
Well, yes, unless you're going to fight against climate, unless you're going to try and grow the rare Himalayan blue poppy Mechanopsis betonicifolia, which you really should not do unless you live in a very, very cold climate. You must work within your climate. You must work with what you're given. I think this is very important for us now in the time of climate change and water restrictions, etc. Although we could learn from the Iranians about collecting water, let me just hop on my hobby horse for a little moment.
Well, I did want to ask you, of course, because that's an obvious question. When we're talking about climate change and water shortage, it's a wonderful book in gardening, but I thought, and there are a lot of Australian examples, I might say. We haven't touched on them in the interview here, but there are plenty of good Australian examples here too. What about water and gardening? How do you approach that in our country, for example, and in various places in our country?
Well, first of all, if you look at the Iranian gardens, and they collect all that water, the melting snow is collected in these canals, these wonderful hundreds of kilometres of underground canals, and you think, you know, the old cliche, we can put a man on the moon, why on earth can't we collect all this water that's falling north and that fell in Sydney on Easter Monday? Why can't we send that down to Goulburn and Canberra and other parts of this country? It just seems almost criminal to me that we're wasting water as we do.
So it's a matter of stewardship, you're saying here.
Oh, absolutely. It's a matter, like so much in life, of common sense.
I think one of the last chapters, it's not the last, but it's towards the end of the book, is places to pray in. And you actually look at gardens as specifically that. Now, where did that come from? I think it, from memory, it focuses on Japanese gardens.
Gardens. Well, they're so spiritual and they're so calming. Places to pray in. There is something, I think, very spiritual about a beautiful space, whether it's a constructed space or whether it's Saihoji, the moss garden in the northwest of Kyoto, where 120 species of moss came naturally, but it's a cathedral-like garden that you enter into in a spirit of calmness, a cathedral-like garden among pine trees, copses of bamboo, and this extraordinary covering of moss. And I very much feel, whether it's a constructed garden, as I say, or whether you are on the top of Mother of the Great Western Tiers, to which you have climbed in the north of Tasmania, and that's an untouched wilderness, untouched by human, a beautiful space is a very spiritual place to be. And I think it gives you a chance to sort of reflect upon the world, upon beauty, the light that is derived from beauty, very much a Persian philosophy. Beauty reflects light, deflecting evil. So I very much feel that beautiful spaces, whether constructed or given to us by God, are terribly important and terribly spiritual.
Dr. Holly Kerr Forsyth, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.